All right, I think we're going to move on to our next speakers, Abigail and Celia. Are you up here? Okay, why don't you go ahead and come on up, get you up here, and then I'll introduce you both. Yeah, we can get you sit down, and we'll make it happen. Okay, so this is, you know, we are an advocacy organization, so we can't possibly have enough speakers to tell us about successful advocacy stories. And today we really have one. Abigail Tamara, who is from our Silicon Valley chapter and who is an MAMSW. And Celia McGinnis, who's an attorney. She's a managing attorney of the law offices of Paul L. Rain in Oakland, are going to tell you how they teamed up in an awesome success story of self-advocacy. So without further ado, because I'd rather let them tell the story than, you know, describe what's in the program already, good. Let's hear from Celia and Abigail. Ladies.
Thank you very much. We're thrilled to be invited to be here and to speak to you today. And before we tell you a little bit about ourselves, first I'd kind of like to get a sense of a little bit about you. So could you knock on the table if you have experienced discrimination, been denied access either for a service dog or some other adaptation you needed to have full access? All right. Now, knock on the table if you advocated for yourself and resolved that situation to your satisfaction.
All right. Oh, wonderful.
So we have a great group of self-advocates already. We are going to talk to you a little bit about what worked for us. So as an introduction, do you want to start, Abby, and introduce yourself?
Sure. So I'm Abby Tamara. I have three disabilities. I have macular degeneration, and I'm getting injections in one of my eyes. And I have a bipolar disorder that's characterized by very intense feelings and mood swings. And I also have a back condition. I've had multiple surgeries. And I have my service dog, Inglis, for my back condition, because prior to getting him, I used a walker to get around. He has a rather substantial leather harness, different from the guide dog harnesses. And it was designed by a dog chiropractor for this particular organization, which is Canine Partners for Life in Pennsylvania. And as part of my training with them, access denial was a very strong component. And if somebody came late to training, they had to practice it to be able to continue training and get their dog. They were very serious about it and made a huge impression on my mind. Where are we going now? So at the moment, what I do, I represent consumers for the National Alliance on Mental Illness, the Santa Clara County affiliate, and chair their Consumer Advisory Council, provide programming that our council thinks will be helpful for individuals. I belong to a Yahoo group of everybody that's received a service dog from my organization, and we share problems, tips, how to deal with whatever we come across, because we do have, you know, assistance animals. And just to give you an idea of what my dog does, because the tasks are very different than a guide dog. So besides balance and support, my dog retrieves items, he pays for things, he presses handicap buttons, he carries things, he takes off my jacket, he puts laundry in my laundry basket, He was trained to do light switches, but I don't really have those in my house, so I don't use that. But he does press elevator buttons. So there are lots of things. And the people that were in my training had all different kinds of disabilities. We have seizure alert dogs, heart alert dogs, diabetic alert dogs. There were people that were wheelchair users. There were all different kinds of disabilities that people were trying to gain greater independence with the use of an assistance animal.
And I am Celia McGinnis. I'm an attorney in Oakland, as you heard, and I've always been a trial lawyer, but I came to the idea of disability advocacy and disability rights because one of my three children, Sophia, was born with a degenerative condition that's similar to muscular dystrophy. And so although she had fairly typical development until she was about age six, after that time, her nerves and muscles just stopped responding. And so she went from a child who could pretty much stand on her own and take some steps and could make some sounds to a quadriplegic. And so it was in the process of being her mom that I got secondhand experience of what it's like to live with disabilities in the United States and started to advocate for her for everything relating to schooling, to have, you know, to attend playgrounds and children's events and, I don't know, Easter egg hunts and Halloween parades, and to use assistive technology. She had cortical vision impairment, so I learned some things about vision as well. And it was through advocating for her that I decided to switch jobs and become a disability rights attorney full time. So I now work at a little firm in Oakland, and we represent only people with disabilities. And we represent them in housing discrimination, employment discrimination, and access discrimination, which I define access as more than just are there stairs there, because of course you have to have stairs to get into the building. But access really for me means being able to be fully integrated into whatever you find in that building. And so it's policy access as well as physical access. So I firmly believe that disability rights are civil rights. And you cannot have a civil society, a free society, unless all people are welcome, not just given access, but welcomed and integrated into the community. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk to you a little bit about some ways to advocate for yourself without a lawyer and with a lawyer. And I think everybody in this room probably understands the framework of laws that protect you as a person with disabilities. There's both the ADA, which is only 25 years old, and then there are California laws that go back much farther than that. And I think it's important as we talk about advocacy to remember that the ADA, the UNRU Act, the Disabled Persons Act, none of those just sprang forward out of the foreheads of legislators. They all happened because of advocacy by people with disabilities. And we need to go, I think, all the way back to 1974 when people with disabilities occupied the health, education, and welfare offices in San Francisco, D.C., Philadelphia, and across the country. And in San Francisco, for almost a month, they occupied those offices until Joe Califano agreed to sign the first set of regulations that went with the Rehab Act of 1973. So advocacy is a long-honored tradition in the disability community. We're just going to talk to you a little bit about our small piece of it.
So do you want to talk about your philosophy?
Oh, okay. So I have learned that you really have to speak up for yourself and to ask for what you want. And that the more you do that, the easier it gets. Whether that means talking to your medical providers, to agencies that provide you different services, the utilities, whatever it is. And I found that I will start with the regular worker, ask for a supervisor, and go as far up as I need to go to get what I want. I've gone to the president's office of organizations. I've been involved in appeals units, in whatever I can do to get the desired amount effect. And I found that, you know, a lot of times when companies charge you for something because it's something they've done, you find out about it, that if you tell them that this was unjust, they not only will take away the cost, they will try to make it up to you for what they did wrong. So I've always found that it's very useful to do whatever I can, and I do a tremendous amount of research to find out what maybe others have done. If it's a company, I might go to the Better Business Bureau, find out what comments have been made about the company. You know, there is so much that you can do. Let me see. I guess that's where I'm going to stop.
Can you talk about long runs for appointments?
Oh, sure. So I belong to a clinic that has multiple offices, and if I call up and ask to have a health provider see me and the appointment is a month away or whatever, I will see who there is at their different offices and see if I can get an appointment sooner. I've been able to get appointments the same day by doing that. And, you know, all medical clinics don't have multiple offices, but it's just one thing that I've learned, that there are all kinds of ways that you can get what you want if you just research it and ask for it.
So, naturally, everyone is an advocate in little ways and big ways every day in their lives, but Abby and I came together because Abby came to the point of needing to go beyond self-advocacy and seek redress in the courts. And I want to just give you a brief overview of the two lawsuits that we've been involved in, then have Abby talk about her pre-litigation efforts with Stanford, and then we'll talk about the lawsuit itself. So the first time I met Abby was because she had been hospitalized at El Camino Hospital on the peninsula near San Francisco. She had gone in through the emergency room with her service dog and had no problems in the ER, but when it came time for her to get a room, she was told that she could not have the dog go with her. Because it was her pain management, it was a pain management issue, but because the pain sometimes related to her psychiatric drugs, they decided to admit her into the psychiatric ward instead of into the general ward. Now, 4 days later, they transferred her to the general ward. But at the outset, they said, you can't have a service dog in a psychiatric ward because we don't know how any of the other patients are going to react. So Abby did her best to advocate for herself while hospitalized, but wasn't able to change their minds. And she came to me after she was released from the hospital. And then we filed a lawsuit because we needed to make sure that El Camino changed its policy to ensure that service animals would be allowed to go with patients into the hospital wherever the patient went. The second lawsuit was against Stanford Medical Center. And in this instance, Abby knew that she had to have back surgery. And so she called 2 weeks in advance of her surgery to say, by the way, I'm bringing my dog. Is there anything that, you know, you need to know from me before I bring my dog in? And I'll let her explain her efforts for you, but the bottom line is that she didn't get satisfaction. Then I stepped in and I tried to get them to change their policy in advance of the surgery, but their bottom line policy was, we're not going to allow you to have your dog. You need to have, if you want to have your dog, you need to have an able-bodied handler with you at all times. You need to pay extra for a private room, and if you don't want to pay extra for a private room, we'll put you in a room with a roommate, but if your roommate doesn't like the dog, we're going to evict the dog. So that was the policy that Stanford had at that time, and despite all our pre-litigation efforts, we ended up having to sue. But I think the process of how Abby advocated for herself, both while hospitalized at El Camino the first time and then before her hospitalization at Stanford, is really important to see the kinds of efforts she made. So I think she should talk about that.
Okay, so with El Camino Hospital, I went on the psychiatric ward, and as soon as I saw my psychiatrist, I got her to write a doctor's order allowing my dog. She came back to me the next day and said, no, the higher-ups at the hospital have said no, you can't have your dog. And then they said I had to go through infection control, that the dog had to be tested for MRSA, which is a staph infection. And so the person that had my dog, I had them take my dog to the vet. However, the vet, even though it had the latest up-to-date diagnostic tools, had to send the test out because it's a very rare performed test with a 10-day turnaround. The next thing I did was this Yahoo group I mentioned I belonged to. I did have computer access. I went online and detailed, as things were happening, what they were so that I had a written record of events, which was very important when it went to litigation. The next thing I did was ask to meet with the clinical manager of the psychiatric unit. And I had to chase that person down before he would meet with me. And when we met, he wanted to transfer me to another hospital that would allow service animals. So in my lawsuit, we sued El Camino Hospital and the clinical manager. At that point, with the 10-day turnaround for the MRSA test and them repeatedly saying no, there were no other options I had. So I spent 13 days in the hospital without my dog. The second lawsuit, which was Stanford, I didn't want to have the same thing happen again. So what I did was I contacted Guest Services 3 times. I was passed to IT, financial services, and the administrative office, and the surgical admission unit also. They told me that no, service dogs were not allowed, and that if you showed up with a dog without somebody with you, they would send the dog to a shelter. So then I spoke again with risk management with a conference call to Guest Services. They were going to call me back and tell me their response, which they did. And at that point, when it was no, I contacted Celia to get involved.
So when Abby contacted me about the El Camino matter, she had been released from the hospital. She'd been deprived of her service dog for 13 days. And we decided that since she had tried so hard to advocate for herself while in the hospital and they had said no, we would just go ahead and file a lawsuit. And so we filed a lawsuit with the primary goal of seeking an injunction to order El Camino Hospital to change its service dog policy. The benefit of this lawsuit was not just to benefit Abby and compensate her for the time she'd been deprived of her dog, but it was to make sure that if Abby went back to this hospital or another person with a service dog went back to the hospital, it wouldn't happen to them too. And that's one of the best tools that the ADA and California law provide for people, is they can ensure that they can solve a problem not just for themselves, but for everybody that comes after them. So we brought the lawsuit and said, El Camino Hospital violated the law because it deprived her of her service dog. It has a blanket policy excluding dogs when the law requires you to allow a dog unless there's actual evidence that there's a direct threat posed by that animal. But El Camino Hospital didn't even offer to meet the dog. El Camino just said, no, we don't allow dogs. So we spent a lot of time actually trying to settle that case. And as time passed and we were negotiating with the defendants, it became apparent that Abby might have to go back into the hospital. And so at that point, I felt like we couldn't wait any longer. And so I brought a motion for a preliminary injunction, which said to the court, look, we haven't really, you haven't decided this case, you haven't ruled in our favor, but we want you to order the El Camino to change its policies right now. And in order to win that kind of motion, you have to prove you're likely to prevail and that the plaintiff is facing imminent harm. So that was the evidence we brought. We had an expert who talked about hospital administration who said, look, you know, every person who goes into a hospital has a patient plan, and the protocols of the hospital are modified to accommodate what that patient needs. There's no reason that the hospital cannot create a patient plan that allows for a service dog. And the hospital said, well, what if other people are afraid of the dog? What if somebody wrestles the dog's harness off and tries to use it as a weapon? And the response to that was, you know, well, you took her service dog away from her and you gave her a walker. What do you think is a more likely weapon, a harness that's tied to the dog or a walker that you can yank from her grip? I mean, really. And so in the end, the judge ruled that, yes, we were likely to prevail because Abby had a right to have her service dog there unless there was evidence of a direct threat. And there was no evidence. Abby has a really well-trained dog. And the judge further found that it's the hospital's obligation, it's part of what they do, to modify their policies and protocols to enable a person to have the independence to which she is entitled. And the judge said to them, you have to create a lawful service animal policy and you have to implement it within 30 days. And they did. And they did.
Do you want to say anything about the accessibility rooms? Yeah.
Okay, well. So Abby just reminded me that because when we originally filed this lawsuit, we only filed it for the policy violation. But what happened to Abby is when they transferred her from the psych ward to the general ward, in all the rooms she was in, they were not physically accessible for people with mobility disabilities. And with her walker, she had a very hard time using the restroom, using any of the facilities, and found it extremely difficult and exhausting, and so ended up spending more time in bed than she would have been done had she had her dog and had she had physical access. So I said to them, we're just going to go ahead and expand this lawsuit, and we're going to sue you for all the physical access violations you have in the psychiatric ward and in the general ward. So as part of the resolution of the lawsuit, once we got the policy change, we also got a consent decree that ordered El Camino Hospital to make its hospital rooms accessible for people with disabilities. And
Stanford.
Yeah, and so Abby and I really loved working together. I was so pleased to be able to help her make this change that when she called me and said, you know, I have this surgery coming up at Stanford, and I've been trying to get access for Inglis, and they won't listen to me. I said, no problem. I just got a ruling from El Camino Hospital. I will send their lawyer a letter and say, here's the order I just got from this judge in El Camino Hospital. And I wrote them a letter that said, literally, you folks are about to make a mistake, and I really want to prevent you from making this mistake. So will you please review this order that just came down less than a year ago, and please change your policy to allow service dogs. And so I had these conversations with a lawyer, and we exchanged lawyer letters and for 3 days. And ultimately, they said, no, we're sticking with our policy. The lawyer said to me, I'm afraid the dog might urinate in the hallway. I'm afraid the dog will get in the way of the nurses. I'm afraid the dog will jump up on her bed and hurt her. And I said, you know, respectfully, it's clear that you don't know anything about service animals. And really, Abby's surgery is coming up, so we don't really have time to educate you. I'm just going to point you to the law. You have to let the dog in. And they said no. So go ahead.
So we sued Stanford Board of...
Well, the Board of Governors, you know, the official names. But okay. We basically sued the medical center. The interesting thing was that Abby was in the hospital for 3 days at Stanford and then was transferred to a rehab hospital. And originally the rehab hospital had kind of been leery of having a dog, but I picked up the phone and called them, and they said, oh, okay, thanks for the education. And when Abby went to the rehab hospital, there was no problem. She had full access for her dog. But Stanford would not do it.
And actually, another thing I did when I was in rehab was had pictures taken of the way that I positioned my dog's bed, how I tethered him so that he was, and how he was positioned away from the door so that when nurses come in, he wasn't right in their way. I had pictures of me in physical rehab with him walking in the hall. So I have documentation. And I think documentation is extremely important. Another thing just to mention, with El Camino Hospital, the discrimination lasted 13 days of the hospitalization. With Stanford, although the hospitalization was only 3 days, the discrimination began from my first telephone call until I got out of the hospital. So although it was only 3 days, it was a much lengthier time period. And those facts are very important in litigation. Because they make the whole picture of what really went on.
When we filed the first document in the lawsuit, which is called the complaint, we actually put photographs of Abby and Inglis into the complaint so that the judge or anyone reading it would be able to see, here's Inglis with his harness, his vest saying, I'm a working dog, and, you know, this is the menace that the hospital was facing. Abby is absolutely right. Abby had great notes of whom she called and when. I had the letters in the second case, but in the first case, she also had the note from her doctor, and she had and very clear notes, and she had also given El Camino Hospital a lot of information that by law you're not really obligated to give, but she had given them her vet records. She had given them a document showing her rights as a service dog user. She had really done her
best
to educate.
The certification. In fact, my dog's harness has backpacks on both sides of it. I carry the law book that delineates the law as well as state by state the law. I carry emergency instructions, his rabies vaccinations, his certification when we graduated as a team, which he also has a tag. I go through certification every 2 years, and I have a tag on the back of his harness that has a picture of us with the signed certification. Let me see, there was one other thing I wanted to say. Once Celia said that in the lawsuit we sent pictures of Inglis, it wasn't until El Camino saw those pictures that they had ever laid eyes on Inglis, and it was at that point that their information about what his harness could or couldn't do was derived. But also, once the lawsuit was filed, they made a policy in the hospital that no service dogs would ever be allowed on the psychiatric unit, which, of course, once the lawsuit finished, had to be changed.
So with Stanford, the case isn't entirely wrapped up, but we can say that Stanford has now changed its policy and will be putting its new policy, making its new policy available on the website in accessible format, and we'll be training its staff. So our lesson here is that there's a lot you can do for yourself, but there are some times when you just need to bring in the law, and that's, of course, what the system's set up for. That's why we have these rules. The benefit of it is when the ADA was enacted and when California law was enacted before then, the government decided that rather than set up a bureaucracy, a separate bureaucracy with government lawyers that would do the enforcement, it made these statutes into what are called private attorney general lawsuits. So that if a person, a plaintiff, brings a lawsuit on her own behalf and succeeds, the defendant has to pay her attorney's fees. so the wrongdoer pays. And the benefit of that is that folks who don't have a lot of financial resources can afford to hire an attorney to go ahead and advocate for them, and I can afford to have a law firm because I know I will get paid in the end if I just succeed. So that, I think, I would hope sort of would relieve a lot of people's fears about whether or not it's possible to file a lawsuit, because it really is. And we'd like to take a couple minutes and talk about what it's like to have a lawsuit. From the perspective of the plaintiffs, a lot more than the lawyer, but I'm going to start just to give you an overview of what a lawsuit looks like. The first document you file is the complaint, which says, here's what they did wrong. And then they have to answer. And then in some courts, they send you to a mediation process right away and try and get the case settled at an early date. If that doesn't work, then there's a process of what's called discovery, where this is the stuff that you see on TV of depositions and document production and collecting all the facts. And then there's another chance to settle the case usually. And then oftentimes there's a motion to see if the judge can make a ruling as a matter of law because everyone agrees on the facts. And if that doesn't work, then there can be a trial. That process is long. and it takes a lot of patience. And so what I'd like is to just talk a little bit about what it feels like to be a plaintiff when you're in a lawsuit and you're not in charge of what's going on, and how Abby managed it.
So the El Camino lawsuit lasted 2.5 years. We went through 3 mediations in 2 different locations, day-long mediations each time, and they all required me to spend the night, and in a couple of cases, 2 nights, because of traffic patterns, where they were located. But it is a very long process. Patience, patience, patience. And as I told you, I have a bipolar disorder. And so the stress level, you know, can be very, you know, extreme. But to me, the importance of what it was that we were doing far outweighed what I had to go through at the time to get through it. And my, you know, I suggest tremendous support from the people, you know, that you care about and that you're close to. I found also that being very active in the process, in other words, what information did I have that could help Celia? What kinds of things could I think through that she may not be aware of? What could I do? If she asked for information, I tried to get it to her immediately because I know that, you know, between lawyers going back and forth to each other, the process is just so long, and I wanted to do everything I could to alleviate any extra time. You know, I know that she has a busy schedule. I'm certainly not her only case. And that, you know, I wanted to facilitate in whatever way I could. So being very proactive is extremely important. As I said, I also went on my Yahoo group to get information. Has anybody else experienced access denial at hospitals? Has anybody else been hospitalized? Please tell me the name of the hospital and your experience. What part of the country? You know, I did as much legwork as I could to get any information that might be helpful. Let me see. And another thing, since there's a lot of lag time, I wanted to make sure that I knew what was going on. So any questions I had, I wanted to get answered so that I wasn't thinking, oh, what's happening? You know, is this going to, you know, I wanted to have accurate information to alleviate my stress. And so I was very proactive in that way. I think I talked to your office manager, your assistants, you know, anybody that could help me, you know, say what was going on so I, you know, could alleviate my fears. You know, the other side is always going to look for ways that they can tear down whatever your argument is. And you have to be very strong and withstand that and think, you know, this is important what I'm doing. It's important for me and it's important for everybody else that's going to come after me. And those are the things that got me through it.
So as a lawyer, I really appreciated how quickly Abby was able to respond to me when I had questions. And I also appreciated the fact that she would call me up and say, you know, I haven't heard from you in a while. What's going on? Because every lawyer wants to do the best for her client, but we can get distracted. And sometimes we get distracted with the legal issues and we forget about the human factor. So I was always grateful to receive a phone call. And the folks in my office also, anybody who answers the phone will do what they can to help our clients when we call up, when they call up. As lawyers, you know, unfortunately most lawyers who do this work do not have disabilities. And so I know that when I approach a case with a person with a disability, even with my own experience, I may be working from a point of profound ignorance. And certainly I have stepped in it myself quite a number of times as regards disability culture and just simple day-to-day things. And so I find that it's really important for me. I have to ask questions that normally people don't ask each other about, I don't know, how do you toilet and those sorts of things. It's kind of awkward to ask sometimes, but what I really appreciate is when I do make a mistake, my client says to me, you know, that's not really how my life looks. This is how my life looks from my perspective, and this is what you need to know. Because having that information makes me a better advocate. So I need to know things that didn't even know that I needed to know. And so I always appreciate it when my client is willing to sit down and be very candid with me from the first. Sometimes it takes a while to develop a relationship of trust, but it's important to get there, and it's important to spend enough time together so that you get to have a personal relationship as well as a legal relationship. I forgot to mention, and Abby's urging me to mention the fact that I sit on the California Commission for Disability Access, and the State Senate has just confirmed me to a second term. thank you. And I don't want to digress too far, but the CCDA, the purpose is to ensure access for people with disabilities, mostly physical access, by educating business about how they can make their businesses more accessible.
And I just want to add that I have listened in to the meetings. They are available, accessible for individuals, and there is also time for input by individuals, and I have spoken out, and I urge anybody else interested to get involved also.
So that's our story, and we wanted to leave enough time for people to ask questions, either about what happened to us or about something else you might have a question about on any of the topics we touched on.
These are dots that you put on, like, temperatures on ovens and things so you know where to go.
Interesting. That's cool.
I'm particularly interested in hearing about the situation in the hospital. In my former position as ADA compliance officer for the city of LA, I had a call from a woman who was incarcerated overnight and wanted to and complained because they wouldn't let her service dog in the holding cell with her. So I'm interested in how you addressed, if you had to address it, the issue of assuming you were not permitted out of the ward, how you would take the dog out and how you would feed the dog or whether someone else would be responsible. How did you deal with that issue if you had to?
So first of all, if you don't have family members to come in and take the dog out, and I did it 3 times a day, you hire a dog walking service that comes in, takes the dog out, you give instructions, and brings the dog back. I have food in certain places that I'd have people bring to me in a container. Actually, at El Camino Hospital, they have an outdoor fenced-in area that people that have privileges can walk in, so that would have been an easy, accessible issue. But people just have people come in and take the dog out and bring the dog back. The law is that unless it's an operating room, burn unit, or immunosuppressant area, the dog has access. Unless the dog is inappropriate, is aggressive, soils, whatever. But you know, I never rely on any staff. It's always who I hire or friends or whatever to come in and take the dog out.
And from a legal perspective, The statute, the root law, says that hospitals and other government entities and other businesses shall modify their policies. So a part of it is looking at the situation you're in and seeing how access can be ensured in the physical, the geographic location where you are. So as Abby mentioned, this psychiatric ward had an enclosed courtyard. There was no need for Abby to leave the ward in order to toilet her dog. At the hospital, if she wasn't physically able to go outside, she was able to hire someone else to do it or have friends come in. On the question of a service dog in a holding cell, that is a very unique situation, which I'd love to talk to you about. It might... Okay, I'd love to hear it, because there's only two exceptions to access for a service dog. And one is that the dog presents a direct threat, which has to be actual evidence that there's a threat. Like, you can't have a dog in a burn ward because there's just too much chance of infection. Or you actually see this dog misbehave. It has to be evidence, not fear or speculation. And the other exception is if the presence of the dog would fundamentally alter the nature of the service. So dogs are not allowed in zoos and safari parks. That's just sort of because it's just incompatible with a safe atmosphere for the other animals. Not that the dog would misbehave, but the animals would.
Is it California? Because yeah. My dog was at the zoo. We trained at the zoo.
Well, if your dog has been allowed into the zoo, don't tell them.
Don't say anything.
Don't say anything. But it's actually so. What I'm trying to point out is if somehow the presence of the dog itself fundamentally alters the nature of the service, I think the jail might have an argument about that. but you know, it's certainly worth advocating to see what's possible. And you may not get the whole loaf. I mean, that's one thing. There are very few lawsuits that are as stunningly successful as the ones Abby and I have had. But it's always worth trying, and at least you can get some improvement if you can't get what you've ideally like.
Now, my organization in Pennsylvania uses puppy raising programs in a number of prisons in Pennsylvania and Maryland. And they feel that the inmates benefit from having dogs assigned to them to train.
Stop.
Dead again. I'm alive. We're going to have to call time because we're going to be running behind schedule if we don't, and we have a very important other speaker. But I want to thank both of you ladies for an excellent tag team presentation. We love to hear stories like that, and there's so much positive to learn what Celia and Abby did.
And I just want to add, I am going to be here until tomorrow, so if you see me around, I'm happy to talk to anybody else. Or, I'm sorry.
Great.
Let's
thank
see.
You again.
So, Celia, you'll have to say, this is Celia.
I'll make myself known to folks.
Okay, so, I'm sorry, what was that?
Contact information.
Yeah. Contact information for Celia?
Yeah.
Okay. Celia's contact.
So I can give you right now, and then I can go to the back of the room and hand out business cards, but I'll give it to you right now, my cell phone number so that you can reach me while I'm here. And it's 510-388-7500. 3-2. And you can use that to call me now or at any time. And also, the name of my law firm is in the program, and it's the Law Office of Paul Ryan in Oakland. So, or you can Google me, and I'm happy to talk to anyone.
All right, thank you very much, both of you. Okay, we're going to have two quick announcements before we go on to our next speaker. I'm going to make the first one, and that is that, as you know, our first item of business at this evening's session is always remembrances of people who have passed since the last convention. And the reason I want to underscore that is that at the end of that particular item, we will do a special tribute to Winifred Downing, and I would ask those who have remembrances of her to get them ready for us so that we can all remember her well this evening. Okay, Pam Pology has a lost and found announcement, I believe. Mic is not on.
Now it is, I think. Thank you. I just wanted to let everyone know, and I don't know if these two women are in here or not, but if they're not, please pass the word to Artis Bazin and to Esperanza Gaze. I picked up some paperwork for both of you that was in the room last night from the nominating and from credentials, and so I took it to registration so that it's there safe. I know that when I got to registration, they said you guys have been looking for it, so if you get there today before 5 or tomorrow during the day, it's there for you, and I thank you.
Thank you.